Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 450th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a singer-songwriter who the Los Angeles Times has described as, quote, an artist who has defied most of the modern rules of pop stardom in her unexpected ascent to the top of the charts, close quote, and whose music Time has called, quote, relentlessly positive and impossibly catchy. Bangers that synthesize pop, rap, and R&B with hooks so sharp it feels like they've been in your brain forever. Her lyrics are funny, bawdy, and vulnerable, reminders to dump whatever idiot is holding you back and become your own biggest fan. Close quote. Now 34 years old, she has already been hustling for years, but she's only been famous since 2019, when her third album, 'Cause I Love You, led by the songs Truth Hurts, Good as Hell, and Juice, took the world by storm, ultimately bringing her a field-leading 8 Grammy nominations and 3 Grammy statuettes, as well as leading Time magazine to name her that year's Entertainer of the Year. A self-described big girl, she preaches body positivity and self-empowerment in her music and in everything she does, including on her Amazon Prime reality competition show, Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls, which recently won a Critics' Choice Award and is now in serious contention for a Primetime Emmy nomination. She is, to quote her lyrics, 100% that bitch, Lizzo. Over the course of our conversation at her home in the Hollywood Hills, Lizzo and I discussed the role that music played in her life as a child and how the flute entered the picture. Her darkest periods, like when she suddenly lost her father, dropped out of college, and stopped talking to anyone for a long stretch of time. And her brightest, like when Prince took her under his wing. How she learned to love herself, and why she feels it's important to help others learn to do the same, not least on Watch Out for the Big Girls, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Lizzo, thank you so much for doing the podcast. Great to have you on here. And we always begin on this one truly at the beginning. Can you tell us where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I was born in Detroit, Michigan. I was raised in Houston, Texas, and my parents were entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you help us connect the dots? I know it started out Melissa, Vivian, Jefferson. There were a few steps on the way to ending up at Lizzo, right? Can you break it down?
A few small steps. For a man.
Yes.
And one large step yes. For my LLCs. So Melissa is my name. And in my group, Cornrow Click, you know, we were doing a thing where in Houston, you take your name and you put an O on it. So my friend Alexia, she's Lexo. We still call her Lexo to Rillo to this day. And I was Lisso, L-I-S-S-O. Actually, I was Mio for like a day. And I was like, guys, what? So I was Lisso, and I feel like, you know, people were going, hey, Lizzo. It was just like, they just put the swag in it with the Z's. And I was like, I think it's cooler with the Z. It's more striking.
I love it.
So somewhere between middle school and college, I went from Lisso to Lizzo.
I love it. Well, prepping for this, I learned a lot about you. And one of the things that I found interesting was that your, I guess it's your great grandparents actually founded the church that you grew up in. Is that right?
Yeah.
And that was really a big part of your upbringing, right?
Absolutely. Kojic, shout out Church of God in Christ.
Yeah.
Mama Kirkwood, my great grandmother, and Daddy Kirkwood, her husband, they started a family church. And they moved to Detroit, I feel like in the 30s. Mom, it was the 30s. My mama not here no more. And, yeah, I grew up in this church at Mercy Faith Temple. And we would go to church every Sunday. And the congregation is your family members. And the choir is your family members. And the band is your family members. And the elders are your family members. The bishop. And I'm so used to that. I'm actually not used to the opposite, where it's like, oh, no, the congregation is a bunch of people who come together who aren't blood related. Like, it was like a few people who weren't blood related who became like family to us.
And that's where, as with many great singers, obviously, probably most famously Aretha. Is that where music first entered the picture for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was music in church is transcendent, especially Black church, where you catch the spirit and the Pentecostal sect of Baptist church, you catch the spirit and you run around, and it's the music that drives that. It's, of course, it's God and it's the connection to God and the word, but there ain't nothing like a doo 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 to really get you to elevate. And I remember being, you know, exposed to that at such a young age. And then there's, you know, praise and worship music and the reverence of like a choir singing quietly in harmony, and feeling like outside of your body and connected to a higher source. I think that's where my music, it's not even like where it began. I was born into it. Mm-hmm. It's like woven in my DNA.
Now, were you allowed to listen to other kinds of music at home?
No, I wasn't. For first 10 years of my life, I was listening to the Winans, and we listened to Stevie. Stevie was cool, you know what I mean? But it was strictly gospel music. Clark Sisters. Yeah, we weren't able to really listen to radio or secular music or devil music.
And so when that other world of music opened up to you, or I guess you were old enough to be allowed to do it, or you just did it because you wanted to, whatever. I have read, I'm going to just say three examples that I've heard were big for you, and then correct me, obviously, if it's wrong, but Destiny's Child, Queen Latifah, and most of all, maybe, I'm looking at a beautiful picture of you two right now, Missy Elliott?
Yes.
Why were they so powerful and influential for you?
I'm going to start with Queen Latifah because she was more than like a musical influence, obviously, because she really, her rap reign kind of had transitioned into TV and just being a household name when I was a kid, when I was a baby too. So it was more of her existing that had an effect on me and how multifaceted and how everything she is. And also, it was the only celebrity that people would say I looked like.
Oh.
You know?
I will say, I'm looking, when I came in today, this People magazine cover of yours, I don't know. I honestly thought for a second.
Am I giving Dana?
I thought it was.
So, I mean, what a powerful, you know, ode to representation. Having a celebrity was like, you look like Queen Latifah. I'm like, wow, I look like somebody. And I think that was really special for me as a kid. Missy Elliott, obviously just being one of the most talented songwriter, producer, singer, rapper, dancer, creative, artist, performer, style icon, like literally of all time, like seriously up there. Put her next to Prince, Michael Jackson. I don't care what happens after this podcast. Come for me. Don't at me, though. I'm sensitive. But seriously, and it was actually like, what a privilege to be born and to witness that in real time. Like, all of us are very, very whoo, I'm emotional. Lucky to have witnessed Missy Elliott. And she's here. Thank God she's here. So that was important. And then Destiny's Child was and is one of the greatest girl groups of all time. And they came from Houston, Texas. I moved to Houston, Texas when I was 10 years old. And that's when Destiny's Child was like blowing up to be the biggest thing on the planet. And everyone had a hometown hero story about the girls. And that made me feel like it was possible for me too.
And in fact, you had a few girl groups of your own as a kid. And was that, it was interesting reading that, you know, you're singing about, I believe, like, broken homes and stuff that like you were not thankfully personally experiencing. Yeah. But like, is that the first time kind of writing, I guess, that's its own art form when it's not your own experience, right?
It's interesting because I was like literally so young when I wrote that song. I had to have been like 11 or 12 talking about broken households, children lost hope, family struggling, battling sin. And I had a whole verse with a little girl being like, "Mommy, I need you." I'm like, what? But you know, it's interesting because like that was my passion to write a song like that, and like I guess some things never change.
Oh, that's amazing. That's how early the seeds were there. Well, and I guess at around the same time, can you tell our listeners who was James Brown?
Who was James Brown?
No, Brown.
James Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, I thought you said James Brown. I'm about to say, I'm
get out of here.
Brown.
Get out of my house. Yeah.
I got scared.
No.
Yes, Mr. Brown. Mr. Yes. Brown is my first band director. And he was the band director of the Young Blood Intermediate School Band, concert band, and jazz band. Give it to him. And he made us so cool. We were the bad. He would call us the baddest band in the land, which I think, like, as a 12-year-old, like, playing, like, a instrument, you're like, really? You know? And he made it very cool to be in band where you don't hear that actually synonymous with being in band at that age. You hear band geek, band nerd, but like it was like, no, at our school it was like we're playing songs off the radio, we're playing Biggie Smalls, we're playing hits, where we got choreography, we're on the local news playing, talking about chocolate chip cookies and milk, stomping, you know what I'm saying? Like we really did that. And I feel like he made me fall in love with music. One of the best teachers I've ever had in my entire life. And I started playing the flute with him.
I was going to ask you. So like, was that just like, all right, everybody pick an instrument or somebody suggested, like, cause that was a big moment in your life. The fact that you ended up doing the flute instead of anything else. How did that happen?
Almost like so important that if we were doing like a movie of my life, that's like a pivotal scene.
Yeah, right?
It's like the scene where you pan in and it's like the music swells. I was chosen, which is so ridiculous to say, but it's like, I really was like chosen. It was ridiculously cliche. Everyone else got to pick their instruments. A lot of the kids were like, oh, I want to play drums or I want to play tuba, whatever. And there was one other person that was Mr. Brown, and there was a lady, she was the flute specialist. There was no specialist for any other instrument. And really what I think it was, because I was a kid back then, Now I'm like, I think she was in college, and I think she was like coming to our intermediate school to like, you know, get some experience and everything. And he was like, it was almost like who do you want to play flute? Like a throwaway type thing. And she looked at all of us, and she literally, I believe I was the first person she picked. She smiled and was like, you. And I was like so excited because that's what I wanted to play.
Do you have any idea why she went for you?
I to this day don't know. I have a whisper of a memory that was like, oh, my embouchure. Mm-hmm. Like you look like you would have a good flute embouchure.
Like, is that like basically the shape of your mouth?
The shape of your mouth in regards to the instrument. Because flute is a really difficult instrument. It is a wind instrument, but it has no reed. And a lot of wind instruments have reeds. And, you know, you squeeze the reed, you put the reed in, you squeeze it in, and you kind of can squeeze enough to make sound pretty easily. But flute, you have to actually create, your mouth is like the reed going, directing the air into the head joint. So the mouthpiece, I should say. So I was honored. It's a compliment that I could play this extremely difficult instrument. And I remember from the day one, we started off by holding the head joints and just going into the mouthpiece. And I was like, I'm going to be the best fucking flute player of all fucking time. I remember thinking that when I was sitting there, I was like, I'm doing this. I'm taking it all the way there.
But people should understand, like, you're not joking around. Like, you really we'll get to how this all unfolded in a bit, but I mean, essentially, you were studying, trained classical musician. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, a lot of people kind of just show up and blow up or whatever, but this, there's a lot that preceded people kind of becoming aware of you in the mm-hmm. general. So anyway, but let's, I guess another big step along the way is where singing non-church music first enters, I guess, well, beyond your girl groups that we were talking about. And so what, I guess Houston is really associated with freestyle rap. Is that fair to say?
Houston was associated with a lot musically. It was like, because in Detroit, my entire family was in the church and was there. Mm-hmm. Grandmother, cousins, all of that, aunties. And when we moved to Houston, it was just my immediate family. It was my mommy, my daddy, my sister, my brother, mm-hmm. and me. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a family church. It kind of felt weird going to other churches. There were a lot of mega churches down there, which Mercy Faith is not a mega church. It's a small family church, you know, with an airbrush photo of my great grandma on the wall. And it's like in Houston, you know, these churches had helipads. And I don't mean helicopter pads. Yeah. Where the pastor would fly from church to church. And so we didn't feel comfortable in these spaces. They were too big, too impersonal to us. You know, I mean, we love God, but, you know, the church is really important to how you relate to God. So we lost a lot of our connection to religion. My faith and my belief in my spirituality is stronger than ever, but my religious practice of going to a building of sanctuary every Sunday was gone. Listening to that music was gone. And I feel like it kind of allowed a lot of other things to come in, which, yeah, freestyle rap. Houston is, I would say, the capital. If not, I mean, New York is the capital too of freestyle rap, but Houston, Texas, baby. You didn't go to a Houston, Texas school if you didn't bang on the cafeteria desk or the side of the bus walls and freestyle. If you ain't say, man, hold up, man, what's the deal? You're not from Houston.
And it was clear, like, early on that you were very good at that? Were you unusually good at that?
I was good at freestyling. Yeah. I was... Which is interesting. I could just throw the words together. Even to this day, like Lexo, who I talk about a lot, she'll be like, you can just think of words quick. Like, I can't. And so, I would do it and people would go, oh, you know. But once again, I was still in band. I was still me. So, you know, I wasn't the freestyle queen like I would have been if I had a little bit more confidence. But I was good at it.
So it seems like there were two roads that there was going to have to be a decision at some point. You've got this kind of like classical music side of with the flute. You've got the freestyle rap side. Not that they can't mix. I know flute shows up a lot in rap, actually. People sometimes forget. But but for you, when you were originally planning to, you know, getting ready to graduate from high school, there's a I guess a person who you were studying flute with who made the idea of college attainable.
Yes.
Because you were working with her?
Yes. My professor, Sydney Carlson, who is incredible. She was like so important to me. Saw my skill and my raw talent and was like, let's refine this and turn this into something because you have an incredible gift. And I would do lessons at her house, and she would, you know, really mentor me and helped me get a scholarship to the University of Houston, the Moores School of Music, where I studied flute performance. That was my, you know, I went to school. That was my degree.
With the dream of doing what?
With the dream of going to, she had already set this up and seen it for me. You're going to go to the Paris Conservatory. You're going to study under, and I remember the person's name was Patrice. I don't remember their last name. You're going to study under people like Patrice. Can't remember the last name. And then you're going to be in a, you know, the ballet or the pops or a symphony somewhere. And that was really it for me. You know, I thought that that was a really smart career choice. Mm-hmm. You know, it was attainable, much more attainable than being a pop star.
Sure, sure.
And it was unique enough for me because I always knew I would do something unique. I never thought that, like, the typical route. I never saw myself falling in love, getting married, having kids, and, like, working at a desk. I always saw myself kind of bucking against the norms because even in a symphony orchestra, I was like, I'm going to have crazy hair and I'm going to wear big earrings and I'm going to look different.
Yeah.
Cause even when I would go to flute camp, I would dress up different and people would be like, how are you able to do that with nails? I'm like, I can do anything. So I was always going to kind of stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, life happens.
Well, so yeah, I guess. And it really kind of came to a head sophomore year. You have to, I guess you made a calculation. Like, again, it's these two paths, and what tipped it towards singing rather than classical music?
When I'm looking back on it, I believe it was anxiety. Very undiagnosed. I didn't know what that word was back then, especially, you know, Black person from Houston, I didn't use words like that. I didn't use words like therapy or I'm anxious or I'm depressed. It was more like, I don't know what's going on. I can't articulate this, but I don't like it. I was overwhelmed and I felt a lot of pressure and there was a lot going on in my personal life that I was using school as escapism for. And like the world I was escaping to at school wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm. So when you left school, it's not like that was an easy period for a couple of years there, right? If I have the chronology right, that's when kind of suddenly, right, you lose your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You are living without a home.
Mm-hmm.
What was that period like? What keeps you going when all that's happening around you?
That was a period of my life where I was definitely on autopilot and I didn't have the capacity to like fully experience the spectrum of emotion that I was actually experiencing. I was like very disappointed and embarrassed when I dropped out of college. I was like so embarrassed. I was so ashamed that I stopped speaking and, because I didn't know what to say. I had nothing to say. And I was like so angry and I didn't want to say mean things to people. They didn't deserve it. So I just kept it to myself. And I was like literally silent. Like I didn't speak to people even in the same room. I didn't say hello. I didn't say goodbye. They asked me questions and my mouth was like literally glued shut for months. And I remember being like, okay, cool. I'm gonna just pursue music in a different way. Maybe not flute, but singing, rapping, whatever. It was very delusional. But I went back to Houston because I was with my family in Denver for a little bit. And I went back to Houston and, you know, at that time, my dad had already had his first stroke. So he was already sick and he couldn't work anymore, you know? And I think like, instead of confronting what was happening with my family and my personal life, I was just like roughing it. I was like, all right, I was like so driven to like make something happen so I could, once I made that thing happen, I could take it back and fix my family and fix my personal life. But until then, I had to just focus on the goal here. And the goal was just to change something up, make something happen. And I think like I was doing it very scruffily. It was by the hairs of my chin. I was very irresponsible, I think. It was the irresponsibility that, you know, got me out of where I was living. I couldn't afford to live where I was living anymore. When my father passed away, I didn't want to work anymore. So I stopped. I was like a makeup artist at like a makeup counter in Dillard's. And I remember the day he passed away, I went to work too the next day. And I remember I was just kind of standing there staring into space, and you're like supposed to be a salesperson and like bring people in. And I was just staring into space. And then one of my like colleagues at work was like, "Yo, you okay?" And I was like, "My dad died last night." And they were like, "Go home."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Okay." I was like so catatonic. And I didn't want to do anything. I was like really over like life as it was. I was like, I know this isn't what life is supposed to be. Like maybe life shouldn't be, you know, those kinds of thoughts. And I have been kind of brought down to the bare minimum of existence. You don't got no car. You don't got no apartment no more. You don't got no money. You don't got no daddy. You don't got no job. You are sleeping in the car. You're sleeping in the band studio. You're sleeping on your drummer's floor. You're eating dinner at people's houses when they say, "Hey, you can come and have dinner with us tonight." That's where I was at. And I was like, this is like, I actually didn't even process what it felt like to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I feel like the rest of my life has been dedicated to healing that period.
And it's not like it just flipped a switch and it was better. I mean, people should know that when you were, I mean, I think like for just the thing that blows my mind, I think when you were, the night you won your 3 Grammys, you were up for Best New Artist. This is 2019, I believe.
It was the 2020 Grammys. Yes, I was nominated 2019.
You were, the idea that you were a new artist in 2019, 2020 is nuts, because the amount of touring when we say, but like not touring in a glamorous bus or anything, when you're just hustling to get gigs, right?
Yeah.
That's demoralizing in itself, right? I mean, you were, this is, I guess, I don't know if it was before or after you, there's a point where you decide you're going to Minneapolis, and I don't know if you can share why that was, but I think probably on both sides of that move, before and after, it's a hustle.
It definitely is a hustle, and I'm so incredibly grateful for the life I've experienced, because it has prepared me in insurmountable ways for the life that I have now. And this shit is a breeze. This is a cakewalk, honey.
Right.
And yeah, I met a producer, you know, and I'll keep a lot of things vague out of people's privacy, but I met a producer, and I was in Houston at the time. My band was going through it. I don't know. I was in a rock band, and we were all arguing, getting into it. It wasn't cute no more. And I wasn't Zooming back then. God, what was I doing? Skyping.
Yeah,
I was
right.
Skyping with a, shout out Skype, with a producer, and he lived in Denver, but he's from Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So he would be like, "Hey, you know, if I send you beats, can you like sing on them?" And I was like, "Yeah, I can sing on them. I can rap on them too, you know, because I can do everything." He was like, "Cool, do it." So I would just like send him stuff back and forth. And then he was like, "All right, well, dude, come to like Denver and like be in my band." And I was like, "Okay, my mom is in Denver, you know, I can go out there." So I did that. And we like did the Denver scene for a year. And he was like, "Yo, I'm moving to Minneapolis. Do you want to come with me?" And I was like, There were a few things that made that decision for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna just keep it real short and cute. But I went down to South by Southwest, and I went there every year. I've been going to South by Southwest as old as I could go. I went as a thought all the way to headlining shows.
Oh my God, wow.
But I went, and every person I met, every band I saw was from Minneapolis. I was like, does Minneapolis even have a scene? And then he was like, yeah. I went to South by Southwest. I was like, where are you guys from? Oh, Minneapolis. Where are you from? Minneapolis. And I was like, whoa, like the universe is saying, go to Minneapolis. So I was like, I'm gonna go play a show. We went and we played, I played a show with him. And at the end of the show, there was a girl in the crowd. And when I walked out after the show, she was crying. And she was like, do you live here? And I was like, no. And she was like, you need to be here. And she was like literally crying. And I was like, yo, all these signs are saying going to Minneapolis. So we packed up his Jeep and I went out there. Like, my mom was like, you can always come back if it doesn't work out.
And meanwhile, within a year of being there, I guess you connected with the people. You're going to do your first solo album. This is in 2013, Lizzo Bangers. And the second is 2015, Big Girl, Small World. And I guess the other that you, I know you had some girl groups there that you were talking about earlier. I think it's in the same time period that you got your first taste of maybe some national attention. Because I believe in 2014, you were saying is when you did Letterman. And actually just one thing about that, I guess the second album, I believe it included your song My Skin.
Yes.
Which you've said is, quote, the beginning of my body positive songwriting journey, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you decide for the first time with that one to address that subject matter?
I think there were things happening, very like broad political things happening, and then very like personal intimate discoveries. And I took both of those things, which is kind of the formula for a Lizzo song.
Yeah.
Inadvertently, and made them into something that I wanted not only for me, but for other people to find useful and to help themselves. There was a, there was an interview I did around that time where they asked me my favorite thing about myself. And I was like, oh, my personality. And they were like, oh, that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about physically. And I couldn't think of anything. And when I finally decided, oh, my skin is my favorite thing about myself, I just started crying in the interview, which is so embarrassing now to think about it. But it was like I hit a very tender nerve and a self-discovery I didn't even know. And I was like, wow, I love my skin. And then, you know, in the same time period, there was a police murder like a block from my house in Minneapolis of a young unarmed black man. And I was like, the thing that I love about myself the most is the thing that I'm hated for the most in this country. And it was just like blowing my mind. And I was like, I need to articulate this in the best way that I can. And it was through music. And I think I found the way that I felt after writing a song like that is the point.
Yeah.
I think writing music selfishly is great, and I know how to do that, but I've realized that my purpose is to create music that can heal and help and make some kind of change, even if it's on an individual level, and that was the beginning of it.
Well, that's great. The other last thing I'll ask you about Minneapolis is, you can guess where this is going.
Yeah.
I guess after quite a while being there, you're becoming more of a known person, so much so, and I guess this was, or locally, so much so that you get on the radar of the most legendary musician to ever come out of Minneapolis or to be in Minneapolis, Prince.
Yeah.
How'd you first hear from him?
Well, it wasn't, here's the incredible part, is that I wasn't actually getting well known before, you know, he reached out. It was, my first girl group. We did a documentary because I hadn't even done Lizzo Bangers yet, because on Lizzo Bangers, I had a song called Paris that Prince loved and he wanted me to perform at his album release party. All right, we'll talk about that later. But he saw the girl group, me and Sophia Ayers, my DJ, and another girl. And because Plectrum Electrum, his girl group, yeah, we were all in the same documentary, local documentary. And he was like, who are those girls? And he contacted The Current, the radio station, and they said, you won't believe who just emailed us. And we were like, oh. And after that, it was just like, come to Paisley Park. It was Easter Sunday the first time. And he wanted us to get on a song. And so we got on Boy Trouble. And literally just one of the most surreal experiences of my entire life. And I've had lots of surreal moments to the point where even talking about it feels not real. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, yeah, it's not real.
Because, I mean, he, I know, like, when he took an interest in a young artist, he actively, genuinely took it. Like, I know for you, yeah, it's not like a one-time thing. You're there. You were there. Mm-hmm. Sounds like quite a bit. You were on his album in 2014.
Yeah, and he talked about me in articles when nobody was talking about me.
Right.
Nobody was checking for me. He said, Lizzo is next. I mean, that kind of confidence that someone can have in you, like, I've never had any cosigns, like, you know? And I feel like in rap, because I was really a rapper back then, I was rappity rap, 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 blah, blah, blah. It was like, man, I was waiting for that cosign from somebody. I was like, why isn't anyone proud of me? Why, you know? And Prince was like proud of me, and not only proud of me, he believed that, you know, I was next is like, that has a lot of weight culturally, black culture. Oh, Lizzo next. For Prince to say that?
Well, and so he was obviously right, and he saw the beginning of that, right? So you actually had just gone off to LA for the first time, just moved to LA, right? Mm-hmm. When he passed away.
Yeah, I had just moved to LA. Yeah. Yeah, I just, it's like still hard to talk about because there's just so much like, love and respect there. And it was just so much to learn and do. And it's sad, but
he would be so proud though. Look at this. It's amazing.
I'm so grateful. I'm absolutely so grateful. So thank you.
So being in LA, I guess, is when you met another person who was then going to become similarly, I would say, maybe similarly important in your development. This is the person who ends up signing you to Atlantic Records.
Yes.
Ricky Reed. and you guys, I guess what you've said about him is that he's basically somebody who told you, you're coming up with lyrics and you don't even know their lyrics, right? I mean, you were kind of selling yourself short in a way, right?
Yeah. What Ricky does, I don't even want to say did, what Ricky does is there's someone inside of me that I'm not, you know, privy to. And that person is continuously like brought out. And just when you think the me is out, Ricky dives very deeply and pulls more out, you know? And I am just so like impressed by that person. I'm like, oh my gosh, Lizzo, girl, who is this? And I can say that it was like, there was this one moment in time that I can really say, I was like, whoa, what's happening? And it was when I was recording the song Worship from Coconut Oil. And, you know, Ricky said, I was like so into my rap. I was like, I'm a rapper who can sing my hooks. Like that was my thesis about myself.
Right.
My pull quote. And Ricky was like, can you sing? And I was like, yeah, 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 I sing. I can do like melodic stuff, like very chill stuff. And he was like, okay, can you sing this and this note? Ah! You know, like, and I was like, I'll try. So I hit the hands to the sky, show me that you're mine. That part, that's way lower than it actually is. And I was singing it full out, and I felt like it was a disembodied voice, like the vocal that was coming out of me. I don't know if it was the headphone to the situation. I don't know if it was latency for all my producers out there, but I was like, whose voice is this? Like, I couldn't even feel the vibrations coming out of my like vocal cord. Like it felt like another person. And after that, I was like, oh, I guess I can like sing. I guess anytime somebody says, hey, can you sing? You say yes.
Well, and so that was, you mentioned Coconut Oil. That's 2016 EP, which also had Good As Hell on it.
I do my.
You kind of up until that point, I guess, thought of yourself as primarily like an indie performer. This is now, all right, this is a radio song.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is like cool. Like songs that are like big pop songs that I write scare me. Like I'm always like, oh, I'm scared of this one, you know?
Why do you think?
Because of its potential, I think. The potential is bigger than I can see, and it just freaks me out. I'm like, what is this going to mean for my life? Like, am I going to have privacy anymore? And Good As Hell for me, when it came out, it was in Barbershop 3. I got to go to the premiere. Ice Cube was there. Nicki Minaj was there. I was like, whoa, like, this is about to be, I'm about to have a number one song. And then it, you know, didn't go number one or any, it didn't chart like that. I don't think it charted at all.
Well, it's interesting because you're saying, I think a similar thing happens with the next year. I think that it would have been with Truth Hurts. You put it out in 2017. It wasn't until 2 years later that it actually blew out. Like there's all these things where you're essentially maybe like getting a false alarm, like this should be the one that does it. This is going to be the one. And right.
Yep. And you know what? When I say the one, it was, I never made music for the purpose of it blowing up and blowing me up. Like I always made music to be like, this is like the best thing I've ever done. Everyone should hear this. That was always like my mentality. And with Truth Hurts, I was like, oh, this is like the best thing and the best music video I've ever done and the best song. And I was like, this is insane. Like, I was really scared. Yeah. When I make big songs and I'm scared, this one, I was like in the corner, like, cause it was just that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the song dropped and actually it was the music video and the song were supposed to premiere on a major blog and magazine. And then it went dark. They went dark the day of. And I was like, oh, so they're not going to drop my video? They're not going to drop my song? Does anyone care? Does anyone care about me? And it was really depressing. I was like, update. I was like, is it out? Is it out? And they're like, they're still dark. We haven't heard anything. And I was like, yeah, this is a sign. Like, maybe I should just stop, you know?
Oof. And this is with the song that ends up going 7 times platinum. It just took 2 years for people to catch up with it. Maybe a little help from the Netflix movie that featured it, Someone Great, right? But I mean, we have to, this brings us to 2019, which was the year that everybody.
Also, we might be 8 or 9 times platinum.
8 or 9 already? Okay.
I think so. I'm not sure.
Let's get that Wikipedia updated,
we'll
guys.
Get the Alana.
But okay, so I think most people discovered you in 2019 with 'Cause I Love You, your third album. You've said that this was the one that kind of set, that was different from others before because you're being more vulnerable than maybe before. And drops in April 2019, right about the same time you're performing at Coachella. Yeah. And I guess life was probably never the same after that. So can I ask you just a thought or two about several of these singles that people, you know, can't stop playing since then?
Please.
Thank you. So, you know, we talked about Truth Hurts, took these 2 years, comes back. I don't know if it was re-released or if it was just, it was part of that album, right?
Yes.
So
we put it on the deluxe.
Exactly. So this one, number one on the Billboard Hot 100 for 6 weeks. However, at least 7 times platinum. In some ways, I think there was a thing New York Times did, like 25 songs that define our time or something that. And that's one of them. Just the thing that you think about when that song, you know, when you're coming to that song in a concert or whatever, what that song represents to you.
That song puts me like right in front of the person that's listening to it. Whenever I do that song, I don't, you know, why you be making people cry a lot? What's wrong with you? Do he be making people cry?
Once in a while.
Yeah, I've been saying this a lot, and a lot of people have been printing this, and I'm like, when I was a little kid, one of my dreams was to write a song that the world could sing back at me. And I think I've been so wrapped up in this album promo and work that I need to stop and realize you did.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the song. That's the song of like little me's dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. Mm-hmm. And it feels incredible to stand there and just with one single note, doom, doom, you know, like people go, one piano hit, people go bananas.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Another one on that one. Just incredible how many songs that everybody knows from this album. Juice. I think you performed it on Ellen and that ignited that one. Right?
Yes.
Right through the roof. Also multiple times platinum. Just I love that even like Terry Gross on NPR is asking you about Juice. Anything you want to say about Juice?
Juice. I'm so proud of myself for Juice because that was a big moment for me as like a boss when it comes to like bossing up and speaking up for myself. Like we were close to the end of the album process at that time. And I had written a lot of songs and I had gone through a lot, you know, emotionally and mentally in the studio. And it was a really kind of hard time for your girl. and I remember I had Ricky Reed in the room and Teron Thomas, who is my collaborator, only person I trust in the room with me. And I was looking at them and I was like, kind of really fed up. And I was like, yo, you make hit beats and you write hit songs. So do what you do. Do your jobs. I'm leaving and I'll be back. I was like, first, let's pick a, I was like, and then I came back and I was like, all right, let's pick the track. And I heard the guitars and I was like, that's emotional. That boom, 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 boom. And I was like, that's emotional. Y'all write the song. And I never do that because I'm such a, I gotta be a part of this. And I left and then I came back and the song, the All I heard was mirror, mirror on the wall. Don't say it because I know I'm cute. And I was like, let's go. And I was so in it. I was like, this is my baby. I'm invested in this song. Let's go. And we took it to this place that just kind of went above and beyond. But I was really proud of myself for bossing up because I had been going through so much in the studio. And I'm so proud of the way I fell in love with that song and the way that I took that song to the place it's at. It's disco. It's fun. I didn't realize I was doing. And, you know, now we see all this disco and we see all this funk. And I was like, this is a weird song. And now this song is like right at home with the landscape of pop.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm super proud of that. I take ownership in that.
Now, how about you get to collaborate with one of the aforementioned heroes, Missy Elliott, on Tempo? That's got to be pretty cool when most people don't get to meet their heroes, let alone, you know, not to say nothing of collaborate with them.
So that's great. I got stories on stories, but I'll just say very simply, like, you know, Missy Elliott reached out before Tempo, like I think like a year or so. I hadn't seen her in years before that. And was like, hey, come in the studio in Atlanta. And I was like, huh? Like literally, I thought I was, never mind. I'm not even. My anxiety is so wild that I thought I wasn't gonna live to be able to go in the studio to meet Missy Elliott. I was like, my life can't get that good.
Right, right.
So after having a panic attack and talking it down and talking to several people, therapists, medium, friends, family, God, I finally got in the studio with her and I was too stunned to speak. The woman was too stunned to speak. I was like, how do you communicate with the, how do you use words? And I was playing Missy some of my music that I had written, and a lot of it I was like, I know she like
not so into it.
Well, she was like, you know, it sounded like her.
But that's a compliment.
It was like, say my name Melissa, and she's Melissa Elliott, you know, the Melissa Elliott. And I was like, this is wild. She's just looking at me like, girl, I see you, you know. And after listening to everything, she was like, wow, you know, you got to remember to take it easy on your genius brain. You have a genius brain like me. And I was like, whoa, she thinks I'm like her.
That's cool.
She called me a genius. And she threw me in the booth a bunch to freestyle. And I freestyled and I freestyled and I freestyled. And it was like the freestyle Olympics. I would do it three times. She'd be like, all right, new track.
Right.
Three times, new track. I was like, wow, this is incredible. And after that, like a year had passed. And that was like my time with her. And then when we wrote Tempo, I was like, yo,
pretty amazing.
What if Missy hopped on this? And she did, and it's incredible, and the rest is history.
Totally. I'm a thick bitch, I need tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Slow songs, skinny hoes. Fuck it up to the tempo. So, just to note, the rest of that year, you were in Hustlers, which was a big, big movie. You were, the Grammy nominations come out November 20th, 2019. You lead the entire field of Everybody in the World of Music with 8 nominations, including one in all 4 of the major categories, best record, best album, best song, best new artist. And on the night of the show, January 26, 2020, and I was lucky enough to be there that night at the Staples Center, you performed 'Cause I Love You and Truth Hurts, and you wound up with 3 of those. I just saw them over in the side here. 3 beautiful little statues. Best pop solo performance for Truth Hurts, best traditional R&B performance for Jerome, best urban contemporary album for 'Cause I Love You Deluxe.
Yes.
What did that night mean to you?
The biggest flex of all of that is that I won 3 Grammys in one night for 3 different genres.
Yes.
Like,
how often has that happened?
Urban and R&B, which is just a testament to how much genre doesn't exist.
I know. you feel really strongly about that, right?
I feel so strongly about that. My voice is the genre. That night, that day was such an interesting emotional day.
It's a Kobe day.
Yeah. I woke up and I woke up and I was like, I am so grateful. And I had never felt the amount of gratefulness ever before in my life. I feel like my whole life I had been reaching and searching and what's next? Oh, frustrated. And I woke up and everything had settled. And I was like, I am grateful was the only word I had. And so I got up and I was just like over and over. I was like, thank you, God. Thank you, God. And I was crying. I was crying. And then I put on gospel music because I was like, whew, I need this. And I walked around that house and I just was singing and crying and grateful. It was just, it had overwhelmed me completely. And yeah, we got there and I just, no phone, nothing like that. And because I was like, I'm just singularly focused on this one thing. And my friend at the time, she was like, I have to tell you something terrible. And I was like, what's wrong? And she told me, and I was like, well, what do you do? What, like, seriously, like, what do you do? How, like, stop everything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Stop everything. And,
And you're at the Staples Center, yeah, where he played.
We were in his house.
Yeah.
And I was like, I feel the same way I feel now. Like, my heart and my spine are like, I was like shaken. And I just sat there for a minute and was like, okay, well, what are they going to do? You know? And it was like, okay, I was opening the night and I'm like, man, Do I just not do it? Do we go home? Do we just turn this into a place where people can come, a vigil? Like, what do we do? And I was like, there's no way I'm doing this unless I just say something. If this show is going to go on, I have to say something. And it was interesting because I'm conducting, right? Like, in my rehearsals, I was like, I want to conduct my black orchestra and I wanted to pause for dramatic effect. And the pause was too long. The whole time in rehearsals, the pause was too long and we didn't shorten it. And they were like, well, the pause is too long. It's going to be a little awkward. That's okay. And then I was fine with that. And then the night of, it was like the pause was like a little too long. And I was like, I have the perfect amount of time to say tonight is for Kobe. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it was like, this performance ain't about me. This award isn't about me. I won the first award of the night. And I was like, this isn't even about me right now. Like, God has put me in a position where there's a microphone and a camera and millions of people. And that times two of ears listening to what I have to say right now. What are you going to do? This isn't about you. You were put in this position because you need to just, whatever it is, facilitate it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's still not about me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't talk about it a lot. You're the first person I've actually kind of gone a little bit more into detail about, because I've always felt like never wanted to take attention from that.
No, well, I'll tell you, though, just as an audience member in the house that night, you and Alicia Keys, who was hosting, I think it really gave some purpose to the night, because otherwise, as you say, like, everybody's kind of looking around like, should we even be here? What, yeah, are we doing? But it turned into a tribute concert in a way. Mm-hmm. And that was because you and Alicia Keys, I think, set the tone for, mm-hmm, for the night. So it was I'm sure, what a mixed emotion night, yeah, because it's one of the great nights of your life in a lot of ways, but always associated with that. But, mm-hmm, I guess this brings us to the home stretch of everything that's happened, mm-hmm, since then, where you had said once before in another interview, quote, I was going into dive bars and getting shit-faced in 2018, and nobody knew who I was, and nobody was bothering me. Mm-hmm. By 2019, I noticed I couldn't go to restaurants with my dancers and stuff, close quote. So in the middle of everything that we're talking about, your life is, you're not only, you know, making successful music, but that comes with being a public person, maybe more than even you could have expected when you were saying you were worried about what happens if I have a hit. And I guess, though, part of what it seems like you've done with that is said, all right, I have a spotlight on me. Let's see if we can, where I go, I can bring that spotlight on other people who I want to highlight, which is basically what Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls is, right?
Whoa, here we are, full circle.
And we should just say this is, if anyone doesn't know yet, I think most people do, reality competition show debuted in March, on which you are seeking dancers ahead of Bonnaroo to join your dance team, specifically seeking what you call big girl dancers, who don't really get a fair shot the rest of the time.
Yes.
And I guess that was even why you... It was less about making a TV show than finding dancers, right?
It was absolutely about finding dancers. But a thing that people don't know about me, I don't talk about, because it's like a personal friend. If you're my friend, you know this. But one of my like dreams is helping people make their dreams come true. And I know people going to think that I'm lying or that I'm being, but I get off on seeing people that I know and love make their dreams come true. Like I'm like for years I've been looking at people and I'm like, use me. Like God doesn't put like people who are, you know, have negative intentions for me around me. Thank goodness. But I'll be like, whatever you need, like I'm here. And there's nothing like that feeling of seeing somebody, like even when it comes to something simple like Christmas, opening up a gift and being like, I have always wanted this. How did you know? That feeling when like, that's like someone's dream coming true and you can watch them and just be proud of them. Like, that does something for me more than anything, honestly, receiving gifts or making my own dreams come true at times. So I think like, Watch Out for the Big Girls was inherently selfish. I needed dancers, but it was this exchange that I'm realizing post production, post show, that it was like, man, I needed them so much. I needed them just as much as they needed me. And it was things like in episode one, Charity, one of the dancers, after her first audition, she was like, I did it. I did it for you, you know? And it was like the way she said it, it wasn't like, I did it for you. It was like, I did it for you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why does this always get me?
Well, but I mean, like you've, as you said, it's 2018 is like what, 4 years ago that you could have gone around and been basically anonymous and or seen somebody and it nice to see you, but like it's not gonna rock their world. You see every one of these people when they come in and you surprise them that you're there for their first, you know, audition or whatever you would call it. Is it, have you gotten used to people responding that way to you?
You know, it's so weird, and I wonder if other people in my position will agree. I be feeling like people faking it.
You think?
I be like, you're not that excited to see me. Like, they'll be like, oh my gosh. I'm like, okay, yeah, right. Like, you can stop acting. I don't think that I have that effect on people. Like, I don't, unless I see somebody who's like, I see they're like, what they're like nervous system shutting down and they're like actually shaking and they're like actually genuinely like viscerally nervous and excited. If they're just talking to me about it, I don't believe it. And that's so wild, you know? I should believe it.
Well, but, yeah, I guess is that what they call imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah, but who wants to have an effect on people? Maybe there are people in the world who want to walk into a room and everyone stares at them and they start screaming and freaking out and crying. I don't want to have that effect on people. I really don't like
when
people look at me.
Does that feel like a responsibility, a burden too? If you mean that much to these people, then you got to almost always be on, right? You got to, you know, was that why you're not sure how you feel about it?
Well, being on is an interesting thing because I'm never like on or off.
Right,
like,
right,
even
right.
My off is, like, pretty on. I think I'm just naturally charming.
That's a
and,
song. Even my
hey,
off is on.
My off is on. I feel like I'm just naturally this way. I think it was more or less like, it's me. Like, I've been me for a long time. If you've been you for 2 decades plus, and then all of a sudden, at a certain point in your life, you, sir, people start going, ah! When they see you, you're going to be like, huh? It's weird.
But do you think with these women in particular, it's not just any fan, right? These are fans who admire you not just because of the music, but because of your refusal to be limited by any other things that they themselves might be coming up against.
Yeah, but it's also them seeing opportunities and their dreams coming true. They're like, wait, I used to dream about auditioning for a big artist, any artist.
Yeah.
And now here's one here, and I represent all of those things.
Right.
I'm sure that they were just as shell shocked as, you know what I'm saying? As not as I, because I wasn't really shell shocked, but.
Well, would you have been if you were in their shoes and there was somebody, because I don't even know if there was I guess for you, the equivalent might be one of the people we talked about earlier, but even they, I don't know if there's quite an exact parallel. If you had come in to audition for something like that for somebody else, mm-hmm. How would you have reacted?
I stay very calm and quiet. Here's the thing. It doesn't matter. Listen, Beyonce, I don't care what happens in my career. Beyonce will always be, I can't even like express it, because she will always be that person that makes me scream, and you know what I mean? Like, I've seen her over 10 times, and my dream was like, ooh, maybe I could be in Beyonce's band. Beyonce had like auditions for like all female band back in the day, you know? I'm like, man, maybe I could be one day in her band, or maybe I could be. And I'm trying to put myself in that position. If I walked in that room for her, like, even when people tell me like, yeah, you know, I've worked with Beyonce. She was in the dance room, or what is it called? Rehearsal space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why do I not know it? I'm in them all the time. A rehearsal space. And she was just, you know, chilling. I was like, what? She was just chilling. What does she wear? What does she smell like? Like, I don't, but I will say this. I'm always very quiet. I get really quiet. Like, I'll give you an example. I saw Beyonce's hand once at a Rock Nation brunch, and she was in a high chair, and I was behind the chair, and her hand was to the side, like resting on a table. And I was like, that's Beyonce's hand. I know her hand anywhere. That's her hand. And I just get quiet and I just stare.
But
and
hasn't,
I don't know what
she's
to do.
Come and seen you, right? So is that where it really, what's the phrase where it basically gets to be like more than a mind can handle?
I chose to not look at her.
Okay.
Because I was so afraid that it was her. I remember when I saw the flash of blonde in my peripheral, and I was like, that's not, because my dream was that Beyonce would watch me at Made in America. I watched Beyonce watch Cardi B at Made in America just 2 years prior and was like, God, I wish that was me. I want her to watch my show so bad. And she did, and it was happening, and I was like, don't look. Don't look, just perform. And I went so hard, probably too hard, because just like Missy Elliott, I know Beyonce was looking like, okay, girl, you've seen too many of my live shows.
Well, you've said, quote, I ain't new to stereotypes, but what I'm trying to do is dismantle every stereotype that I have the power to do, close quote. And I don't think that was just speaking about this reality show. That seems to be like your mantra or whatever for everything you do. You were talking earlier when we sat down about your fashion line,
Yitty.
It seems like there's a recurring theme. So, and it's also interesting, this idea of positivity. It's not, you know, people want to say body positivity. This is positivity in everything. About somebody goes to your shows or listens to your music, it's all, I mean, even with this reality show, normally a reality competition show, somebody's getting sent home and somebody's being degraded or humiliated, or, you know, you're not good enough. It, this might be the only reality competition show where that just doesn't really happen.
Yeah. Intentionally.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, if I did that to these women, you know, what would make me any different than what society has done? You know, all of these, I've experienced what these women have experienced as well. And the last thing I wanted to do was create a culture that promoted the bullying and the degradation that the dance industry already does to bodies. Why would I do that? Why would I add to the fray? It's revolutionary to do the opposite, which is be kind and to, you know, embrace people for who they are and to create an environment for them to flourish, give them opportunities. I'd rather grow with someone who's not the best at something, but who really wants to be there and is a good person, than the person who's the best in their field, but has a bad attitude about it and is not cooperative and isn't down for me, you know? So I'd rather spend that time. And I think that's what this show was showing the world.
Totally. Well, my last question for you, I so appreciate all your time. We are now less than a month away from your next new music. This is your fourth album called Special, coming on July 15th. So kind of with that coming up, and also with just having talked about how much has happened for you in leading up to this moment, just what's your mindset right now? Anything you want to take us inside, what it's like to be Lizzo in 2022, mid-2022?
It is. It is interesting being me. Everything that I do overlaps with the next thing and intersects with the other thing. And I am optimal is my word. I am optimal in every single way. The album is done.
Congratulations.
It's coming out and it's good. And I'm proud of it. And I want to do everything that I can to let the world know.
Yeah.
I was going to say promote, but that's such a weird word. Because promote has this like obligatory, like, filter on it that's like, nah, I want to brag. Yeah. It's called bragging for me. And with Watch Out for the Big Girls, already award-winning.
Yeah.
I have to say, an
congratulations.
Award-winning show.
Critics' Choice Reel Awards, right?
Critics' Choice Awards. And I'm just so proud of that. Like, I didn't make the show with any type of intention of winning awards. You know, I made the show so that I could have all of these girls on stage with me at the BET Awards, at SNL, and on tour this fall. So I've already won.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So this is like, I'm in my cherry on top phase in my life. Yidi is, I'm so excited about just like what Yidi has done for the mindset and for the language that we use around bodies and clothing and shapewear and looking snatched and feeling good, like with changing that and making that something that's like actually something that you can create for yourself. There's a word for that. Customizable.
Yeah, there you go.
So I'm just excited. And now I'm like, now it's like, okay, Lizzo, you don't have to do that, but I'm doing it. Like, I am always mood boarding in my head. I'm mood boarding as we speak. And everything is a mood board, honey. What I'm about to eat for dinner is a mood board. So I think that I'm just in my like creative jus right now. I'm in my bag and it's a Birkin bag. and I'm just happy to be here. I think everything that I do, anything that you see me do, I'm enjoying it because I'm present in it. And I want to be there. You don't see me nowhere I don't want to be. I wanted to be here with you today.
I'm very honored.
I had so much fun. I'm about to literally get up and go cry in my bedroom.
Don't cry. I can't thank you enough. You are wonderful. And it's so exciting to follow everything you do and just keep up the great work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.